Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. Today I'll be speaking with John Biganay, whose new book is A Meditation on Silence. We'll also hear from poet Christopher Hannon, author of Alluvial Cities, and Sue Keyrose of the Anne Rice Vampire Lestat Fan Club. John Biganay is the Robert Hunter Distinguished University Professor at Loyola University. He's the author of the wonderful novel Oyster and the short story collection The Torturer's Apprentice. And more recently, he's become known as a playwright, and his Rising Water trilogy, the plays Rising Water, Shotgun, and Mold, have been published in book form at last. He's here to talk about that, as well as a beautiful and thought-provoking new book called Silence. John Biganay, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan.
Well, it's nice to see Rising Water in book form.
Oh, I'm delighted. There are so many things when you're writing a trilogy that get lost if there are 2 or 3 years between productions, and the kinds of images that are repeated, the motifs that are developed, and the storylines that sort of thread their way through are available now if someone starts at the beginning and reads through all 3 plays at once.
I know. Don't you have this kind of great desire to have all 3 plays done, like night after night?
They were done at New Jersey Rep. Right after Hurricane Sandy, I had another play running there, Broomstick, and so many people had been traumatized by Hurricane Sandy in that area that the theater on their dark nights, on Monday nights, each week ran one of the plays, and
they did
3 in a row. The reaction was the same as here, though. People would make reservations and then call and said, we've just realized we can't sit through this not come to the theater.
Oh, John. So what does that mean to a playwright, really, to see these works in book form? I mean, I would think hopefully they'll be taught, for example.
I think LSU imagines that this is going to become part of the canon of Southern literature. And so they've classified it, in fact, as a work of Southern literature, but also of Southern history. Right. In a sense, because I really knit these plays together out of the stories I heard when I was writing for the New York Times and then after, it is a kind of documentary of what we went through here in that first year after the flood. But on the other hand, as a work of Southern literature, it takes advantages of our sense of humor, our gift for storytelling. And so I hope it'll appeal to readers who are interested in that as well.
Yeah, it's always so much fun to read a play, I think, after you've seen it.
It is, and it's very strange from a playwright's point of view because as I'm writing a play, which can sometimes take, in the case of Broomstick, 4 years, the character begins to form in my mind, and it's so shocking when a human being steps onto the stage and inhabits the role.
Theater is such a work of collaboration, and you're always working with new people in different groups. You know, you make small changes, and now that you have it in final printed form, do you look back at it and think, oh, I wish I'd done this, or, you know, it's
Paul Valéry, the French poet, said, a poem is never finished, it's abandoned.
Right.
And I think the same thing is true with all writing. There's still a story in The Torturer's Apprentice. There's one word that troubles me.
One word.
And I'm still not sure whether I made the right decision or not, but every time I'm reading that, I stop over that word and wonder about that. So, yeah, it's part of the life of the writer.
With plays, when you do it in book form, then you do have to let it go.
Well, theater, as you said, is collaborative. It's just the opposite from writing a novel. In a novel, you create the entire world yourself. You have to recognize if you're going to write for the theater that there'll be 12 other artists working with you. And if you have any brains at all, you realize they know more about acting and lighting design and set design and music than you do. There are only 2 things a playwright brings to the stage, words and the story.
Right.
So it can be quite exhilarating, but it's a little bit like being on a high wire or a trapeze being flung across the darkness over the heads of an audience, and you just hope the actor on the other end will catch you.
And the life of these plays is ongoing now. There's this recent production at Bayou Playhouse.
Bayou Playhouse, during Rising Water, there'll be a production of Shotgun in St. Louis, and then a production in January of Mold in North Carolina. So they continue to have a very active life. There have been over 30 productions now of these plays around the United States. And I must say, every time I've been to one, there's been a talk back afterwards. Audiences say the same thing. We had no idea that's what happened in New Orleans. We thought a hurricane destroyed it.
I know. I think that's so interesting. You've had, it seems to me, more than the average interaction with your audiences because of these talkbacks.
Well, as I say in the introduction to the Rising Water trilogy, the initial experience was totally unexpected. From the very first preview, audiences would simply not leave the theater after
right.
the play. They simply sat down, and so the director, Ryan Rillette, at that time, stepped on stage and said, "Do you want to talk about what you've just seen?" And for a few minutes they did, but very quickly they were telling their own stories about mm-hmm. either what they had survived or family members had survived. It went on like that for the entire production. As I say in the introduction, tears and talkbacks for 2 months.
Right. That's a burden for you, sir.
I'm really at the point now where I can barely sit through the second act of Rising Water because mm-hmm. I know what's coming. And it's gotten more and more difficult the more I've written about this rather than less. When people talk about catharsis, they're talking about what happens to the reader, but there's nothing equivalent for the writer. The deeper you go into the subject, the more difficult it becomes.
Yeah. Well, let's change a bit. Let's talk about this new book, Silence. This is such a gorgeous book, and it's so brief, but it's so powerful.
I had a maximum word limit in the contract. Mm-hmm. And so in the end, there were many things I had to leave out, in fact. Silence, strangely enough, could have filled many, many volumes.
It could have. Well, it's so interesting to me that it's in this series called Object Lessons. And I don't really think of silence as an object. And many of the other things in the series are objects, like bookshelf, you know, or...
Yeah, the publisher, Bloomsbury, came to me and asked if I'd like to write a book and asked me to propose a subject. And silence was the first thing that came to mind.
Uh-huh.
I think because a writer spends so much time in silence, either writing or reading. So I felt very familiar with silence, but I knew it took many different forms. And so I thought it would be interesting to explore that.
Now, you talk about so many things in this book. You talk about silence as the absence of sound, you know, what we've decided is the quietest place on earth. But as you might imagine, I was especially intrigued by silent reading and what you had to say about that.
I was shocked by what the research has indicated about silent reading. And this is all since 2010 that there's really been in-depth study of what's going on in the brain mm-hmm. when we read silently. And what has been discovered is that if we're reading intently and slowly, the brain thinks it heard it, not that it saw it. And so the auditory cortex makes sense of silent reading. If you skim, on the other hand, the brain imagines it to be a visual phenomenon and a different part of the brain decodes there. So the argument I make is that there's really a conversation going on in reading. A book isn't
yes.
a monologue, it's a conversation.
Well, you know, it's always been interesting to me. I have a lot of trouble reading poetry to myself. Whenever I read a book of poems, I usually have to read it out loud. But that's how I process that kind of writing.
You're in tune with your brain.
I'd like to think so.
Your brain thinks it heard it.
And then you talk about something you know so much about, which is silence on stage.
Michael Severus, who has moved to New Orleans yes. now, has just won his second Tony. He's in Fun Home on Broadway at the moment. We were having coffee on Esplanade, and I asked him about that, and he said something very illuminating. He said, you know, when a juggler is performing, he doesn't spend the whole time throwing the balls into the air. Half the time, he's waiting for the balls to come down. And from that, Michael went on to talk about how a great part of theater is an orchestration of silences, mm-hmm. and that especially rehearsals are figuring out how long silences are going to last between two actors, or between, as he puts it, the actor and the audience. He said those are the most telling moments in a play sometimes, just like a couple who can sit alone silently together. The same thing happens on stage, he says.
Such an interesting combination of trust and sometimes long acquaintance. And a
chance to consider what you've just heard or just seen.
Well, it's just a lovely book. We've been talking with John Biganay, whose new books are The Rising Water Trilogy and Silence. You can meet him Wednesday, October 21st at 6 at Octavia Books, or see him at Words and Music, a literary feast in New Orleans, or the Louisiana Book Festival, both over Halloween weekend. John, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan.
And pray to the neon god they made, and the sign flashed out its warning in the words that it was forming, and the sign said the words of the prophets are written on the subway walls. tenement halls whispered the sounds of silence.
Christopher Hannon is an associate at Baker Donaldson Law Firm, where he specializes in admiralty and maritime law. He lives in Mid-City with his family, wife Emily, son Jack William, and daughter Lila Rose. He received the 2011 Tennessee Williams Festival Poetry Award, and more recently, the Texas Review Press Southern Poetry Breakthrough Award. His new book of poems is Alluvial Cities. Chris, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much, Susan. It's good to see you again.
Now, Alluvial Cities is such a gorgeous book. That cover painting by John Hartman, Wycosky from above looking north to New Orleans, that really kind of says it all.
The funny story about the painting was, in this digital age, there's a very kind of unromantic story about how I found the painting. I actually did a Google image search for Wycosky. And this image came up, and when I saw it, I was immediately taken with it just as an image, and then also it struck me that this kind of fit perfectly with the theme that kind of runs through the manuscript. So I reached out to, I think it was Arthur Roger Gallery is where John had his stuff. They put me in touch with them, and he agreed to let me use the painting. And one of the best tributes to the book that I've received is from John. He sent me an email after I sent him copies of the book and said, I totally agree with you. This painting fits this book perfectly. So that was kind of a good thing to hear.
Well, it makes us realize how fragile our existence is in this landscape. It's really beautiful. And there is an actual alluvial city, Louisiana.
That's right. If you go down, I think it's Highway 46, better known as Florissant Highway in St. Bernard Parish, there's three or four kind of little fishing communities, Hopedale, Wycosky, Shell Beach, and Alluvial City is kind of right in the middle of those. So the title directly speaks to the place Alluvial City, which a lot of these poems kind of are set in and around that area. But it also kind of plays on the idea that the city of New Orleans in general, and certainly kind of this whole region, is alluvial for a lot of reasons, both geologically and culturally. I mean, we're very much a bunch of alluvial cities down here.
Now, you've divided this book into five parts: alluvial cities, trinities are familiar to all of us in South Louisiana, altars, hymns, taxonomies. So I want you to say a little bit about these themes and structures. I'm curious about how you actually assemble a book like this, because when you're writing, do you find that you write poems about similar themes for a while, or do you just create a body of work and then go back and look for the themes to put together into a book?
These poems probably were written over the course of about 6 to 8 years, I'd say. When I was writing them, kind of in the moment, each one of the sections to me probably at some point in time I figured was maybe going to work itself into a full-length manuscript, and that may still be the case as time goes on. But these poems as they appear in this book were never meant to be collected as a manuscript when I was writing them. Uh-huh. That said, a good poet friend of mine, William Wright, let me know that the Texas Review Press was having this contest on the manuscript, and he said, you need to send him a manuscript. And I said, Will, I don't have a manuscript. And he said, well, you need to put one together and submit it. And so that was kind of where this manuscript came from. And in the process of putting the sections together and collecting the poems, it dawned on me that there is kind of a theme that runs through them. So I guess subconsciously, these poems were always connected. I never intended them to be so, but putting them all together, and particularly now seeing them in one place in the book, it really does kind of fit.
Yeah. Now, of course, the section on hymns is inspired by music, which is a longtime inspiration for you. And I wonder if you'd read the poem Tipitina for us.
Sure, absolutely. The hymn section is something I've been playing with basically since college. I had this idea that there's all these folk songs in the New Orleans canon and also kind of the canon throughout the South that are basically stories of anti-heroes, you know, Frankie and Johnny, the Hank Williams song, Kalijah. There's all these kind of wonderful characters.
I loved Kalijah. That was so much fun to come across that poem.
Those heroes in those songs kind of reflect themes that I saw. I was a classics major, and so I saw themes reflected in those songs that kind of have existed in mythology for millennia. Mm-hmm. So the poems in the hymn section, they use the forms of the songs and incorporate elements of the song heroes and the ancient heroes to kind of tell new stories. So in that regard, the first poem in the section is Tipitina, which is obviously after Professor Longhair, Henry Rowland Byrd. And this poem is first in the hymn section because it's effectively an invocation to the muse, as you see in a lot of ancient poems. So with that, Tipitina, Henry Rowland Byrd, a.k.a. Professor Longhair. Tipitina, tra-la-la-la, andara-na-tina-na, Tipitina, ula-mala-wala-dala, ayade, tra-la-la. Hey, Liberta, oh, Liberta, girl, you hear me calling you. Come sing in me one time, baby, like a muse is supposed to do. Say Liberta, whoa Liberta, girl, you tell me where you been, cause you're smelling like a laurel and talking Greek again. You've been hanging on some others in the groves of Helicon, with them girls whose voices whisper in ears of men they fall upon. Leave Terpsichore to her dancing and Polymnia to her songs. Let Thalia kiss them strangers and you come on back home. Swing your hips down off that mountain, girl, you know what we could do. Leave them heights to Urania, but take Arado's tricks with you. I don't want those wine-dark whispers from the lips of Calliope. Just bring your bourbon-scented breathing back to my thirsty throat. Tell Euterpe to keep her lipstick and her rosy-fingered rouge. You don't need no fancy painting when you're with me being true. Clio's had a slew of lovers who I know put me to shame, but I'm more lively than them others who all lie in ancient graves. And I don't want to feel the rhythms from the tongue of Melpomene, because every man she's touched got buried once she came and made him sing. So Liberta, oh Liberta, girl, you hear me calling you, come down and help my singing, for my song is ancient too.
I tell you, the crew of muses needs to stop.
And I'm hoping this translates to folks who may not be from New Orleans, but I tried to make the rhyme scheme to where you have to read the names of the muses the way we pronounce them here in the city,
which is right.
Wrong, but right, depending on who you talk to. So.
Well, I love the way you have that classic scholar within who just, you know, informs so much of what you write. It's lovely.
Thanks.
We've been talking with poet Chris Hannon, whose beautiful new book is Alluvial Cities. You can meet him Tuesday, October 27th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop and again at the Louisiana Book Festival in Baton Rouge, October 31st. Chris, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. It's been great being here.
If you want to know anything about Anne Rice's world, Sue Kiroz is one of the people to ask. She's the co-founder and president of the Anne Rice Vampire Lestat Fan Club and organizes the annual Halloween Ball. And since 2010, she's organized Undead Con, a gathering over the Halloween weekend that includes social events, literary panels, all sorts of things. Sue, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan. I'm really happy to be here. Thank you.
So take us back to the early days. Did you love Anne Rice's work from the very beginning? How did you start this fan club? How has it grown?
Well, my sister told me, you have to read this book. It's really good. And so I did. I read her book, and I was hooked right away. And she just happened to have the Vampire Lestat, too. So I delved into that one. And then I had to wait for Queen of the Damned to come out, which seemed like forever. I used to call the bookstore all the time, so they got to know me. And that was the Garden District bookstore where Anne used to go to do her book signings. So when we went to see her at her book signing, it was at another bookstore in the One Shell Square. And we stood there in line for like an hour. And he said, we should start a fan club for Anne, you know, because we're right here. She's here. Let's ask her, you know.
Nice.
So we asked her when we got up there, and there was like not that many people behind us. So we borrowed paper and pencil and started getting addresses. They said, we're going to do newsletters for Anne Rice. And she invited us to come to her house. They had just moved to New Orleans. So we went over to her house, and she gave us a lot of phone numbers and names and who to call and get information, because back in those days, there was no internet. So
I know, people forget. She's been writing for a long, long time.
And, you know, that was in 1988 when we met her. Uh-huh. And so we started doing newsletters just to let people know when she was doing interviews or when she was going to be on TV and what was happening. So that was the whole idea of the thing. And by the end, we had about 2,000 or so people. But we ended it because the internet was just faster than we could get information. Uh-huh. So we stopped doing it. And at the time, I was working for Anne. I just heard all these people asking me, well, why isn't there a ball? You know, mm-hmm. There's no ball. We have no place to go to wear our clothing. You know, we want to dress up and have fun. And, you know, there was nothing. So in 2002, I started doing the fan club ball again.
And in 2010, you started Undead Con.
I did. I didn't have enough to do.
So now you're 5 years into this event. So tell people what it's like.
It's actually a lot of fun and informative, and you get to be up close to the authors. It's intimate. I want to keep it small because if I go to a big convention, I do not get to see or hear all the events they have going on. You have to pick and choose. What do you want to go see?
Yeah.
You know, and mine is you're there for the first one. We have a light lunch and then we have a second one. So then after that, you're free to go explore or get ready for the ball or whatever, you know, is coming up next.
Tell us some of the authors coming this year, though.
I have Naomi Grossman, who played Pepper in The American Horror Story.
Which we all love.
Yes. Well, she's going to be at the morning events. All of the morning panels will be hers because she's here to promote herself and also to sign autographs. And she's just a really sweet person, so she will be a joy to listen.
Yeah.
And since she's there for 3 days, she'll keep it different, you know.
Yeah. And who are some of the other writers?
I have Andrea Perrin, who actually lived in the house that they based The Conjuring on. She took care of her younger siblings, you know, while all this stuff was going on in the house, and it was really frightening.
Well, and you can get the whole lineup at Anne Rice Vampire Lestat Fan Club's website, which is arvlfc.com. So you have a bunch of wonderful things. You have a Q&A at St. Alphonsus with Anne.
With Anne and Christopher, who are taking questions from the audience. We also have Paul Mercer playing the violin. He's written a special piece for Anne as a thank you for inspiring him. And we will have a silent auction as well because all of our donations go to the St. Alphonsus
Restoration.
Church. Yes.
Because that's a cause that's been dear to Anne's heart for a very long time.
Well, yeah, she was baptized there and she went to the little grammar school. It really needs the restoration.
And people love it. And then, of course, there's the big ball on Friday night.
Friday night, it's going to be wonderful. We are starting off bringing in Anne with the Skins and Bones marching group and the 504 Dancing Man. We also have Paul Mercer and Jill Tracy and the Ghosts Project, which is a band with Paul Mercer, and the Marquis of Vaudeville. So they're kind of steampunk. And we our MC this year is Voltaire, and we love Voltaire. And I'm getting him to sing a song to Anne on stage. She's going to be sitting there in the throne, and he's going to sing to her.
Special serenade. Okay.
Yes, because he mentions Lestat in his song.
Well, it's a rare thing, you know, to love an author, to step into that author's world in this way, in the very place where the author's from. You know, it's a really unusual thing. And I kind of credit Anne with making New Orleans a Halloween destination in the first place, don't
Actually,
you think?
Actually, yes. In 1989, we had our very first ball, and I don't believe anyone was doing Halloween in 1989. And we were at X-Art. It was a little art thing on Gravier Street. It's no longer there, but we started it. There was no one before us. We are the original. And I have some new news. We're trying to do the live streaming from the ball and from the Undead Con.
Ah, that's a great idea. People would love that.
Yes, because so many people tell me they can't make it. You know, they're over in Europe or something, and they just can't make the flights. And so we're going to do that. But we have 2014 already on file. So we're going to start releasing that soon.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, so it'll be, you know, inexpensive, and you can watch as many pieces of it as you want. We might do a package deal, too. But you'll get to see how absolutely fabulous those conversations are.
That's great. Well, thank you so much. I mean, Sue, this is such a labor of love for an author and her work.
It is.
So it's something else. We've been talking with Sue Quiroz, co-founder and president of the Anne Rice Vampire Lestat Fan Club and organizer of Undead Con, which takes place October 29th through November 1st. You can go to arvlfc.com for more information. Sue, thank you so much.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The St. Charles Parish Library in Destrehan hosts a number of author programs during this Friends of the Library Week. Lori Rader Day, author of The Black Hour and Little Pretty Things, speaks at the Friends of the St. Charles Library annual meeting Tuesday, October 20th at 6. The library is located at 160 West Campus Drive in Destrehan. Michael Allen Zell discusses and signs Run Baby Run Tuesday, October 20th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Today's guest, John Biganay, signs his book Silence, Wednesday, October 21st at 6 at Octavia Books. Rick Bragg discusses and signs My Southern Journey, True Stories from Around the South, Wednesday, October 21st at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Lakeisha Simmons discusses her book Crescent City Girls, The Lives of Young Black Women in Segregated New Orleans, Wednesday, October 21st at 7 at the Norman Mayer Branch of the New Orleans Public Library on Gentilly Boulevard. Cela Satterstrom, author of Slab and the Pink Institution, and Teresa Carmody, author of Maison Femme and Requiem, are the featured readers in the Blood Jet Poetry Series, Wednesday, October 21st at 8 at BJ's in the Bywater. Roger Kamenetz presents Poems and Dreamwork at the Dogfish Reading Series, Thursday, October 22nd at 7 at the Old North Villery Bakery, 2448 North Villery Street. David Armand discusses and signs The Gorge, Friday, October 23rd at 6 at Tubby & Coos Mid-City Bookshop. Jennifer Schreiber reads from and signs her new children's book, Saturday at Jelly Roll Dog Park, Saturday, October 24th at 11:30 at Maple Street Bookshop. Marilyn Lacoste reads from and signs Death Embraced, New Orleans Tombs and Burial Customs, behind-the-scenes accounts of decay, love, and tradition, Saturday, October 24th at 1 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. Rhonda Valadares signs Liliat Adventures, Saturday, October 24th at 1 at Barnes & Noble Mandeville. Taylor Kitchings signs his book Yard War, Saturday, October 24th at 3 at Octavia Books. Contributors Aaron Wood, Emily Statt, and Maurice Ruffin discuss and sign the book Scars, an Anthology, Tuesday, October 27th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Today's guest, poet Christopher Hannon, reads from and signs Alluvial Cities, Tuesday, October 27th at 6:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Words and Music, a literary feast in New Orleans presented by the Pirate Sally Faulkner Society, celebrates its 25th anniversary. It takes place October 29th through November 2nd, and appropriately, the theme this year is Out of This World, the Otherworldly in Literature and Life. Featured guests include psychic Carrie Roy channeling William Faulkner, Mary Arno, John Biganay, Elise Blackwell, Brian Boyles, Lori Carlson, Jack Davis, Sally Ann Glassman, Sybil Morial, Michael Murphy, Tom Piazza, Bruce Jones, Julie Smith, Tony Dunbar, Mary Helen Lagasse, and Jenny Tilbury. For more information, check out wordsandmusic.org. Sad news for our literary community. Maple Street Bookshop owner Gladden Scott has announced that the venerable Uptown Institution will close at the end of the year. Over its half century, the shop has served as an incubator for great booksellers, a support system for local writers, the setting for storyteller Colleen Sally's charming Visa commercial, and a welcome stop for families for Saturday morning story times. It's nourished a love of reading and a celebration of writing, and we are lucky to have had it as long as we did. It was the first bookshop I ever visited in New Orleans, and it was the place I came out as a witch during Halloween parties, and my children practically learned to read from children's bookseller Cindy Dyke, always ready with a quick laugh and a good recommendation. Thanks, Maple Street, for hanging in there so long. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.